with us. We know you could've stayed home, just cried and cussed. May all your guns go off if it's time to bust. May all their tanks have time to rust. They got the armies turning bullets into gold. They got the hookers turning tricks into cold. And every time the police kicks in the dough, an angel gas breaks, dips in the O. And even if a D-boy flips in my O, it ain't enough to buy shit anymore. Sleep in the doorway, piss on the floor. Look in the sky, wait for missiles to show. It's finna blow, cause they got the TV, we got the truth. They own the judges and we got the proof. We got hella people, they got helicopters. They got the bombs and we got the, we got the,
we got the guillotine. We got the guillotine, you better run.
Tell the boss to call police to escort them. You don't ride out them lies, you just quote them. Get offline, plug into this modem. No, you can't outvote them, the rules are still golden. Only jewels we holding, if we guarding our scrotum. If you press the ear to the turf that is stolen, you can hear the sound of limitations exploding. Please, sir, may we have another portion with children of the beast that dodged the abortion. Neck plates firm, tune the floor in the portion. We'll shut your shit down, don't call it extortion. Caution, we're coming for your head. So call the feds and get files to shred. Every textbook read said bring you the bread. But guess what, we got you instead.
We got the guillotine.
Majadi Baruti, and you're listening to the Magic City Agriculture Project. First of all, I want to give you a brief understanding, a little understanding of the mission of Magic City Agricultural Project. It is to engage in value-based community organizing, to reweave the threads of the community, develop sustainable urban agriculture as a solution for economic and food justice, and to dismantle racism. Now, obviously, with such a ridiculously powerful vibration inside of that mission statement, you would have to have folks that are going to move this thing. And I won't use the term leadership, because that's been really, really, really overplayed. But we're moving towards movement, and movement involves a number of bodies on so many different levels. And one of those bodies, one of those people that is helping to move Magic City Agriculture Project forward is Brother Zach Henson.
How's it going, everybody? Probably when he introduced me in that way, you probably didn't expect to hear an accent like this.
See, you messed up.
But yeah, I'm the president and one of the founders of Magic City Agriculture Project, and you know, we're a team. Magic City Agriculture Project is a team of people that are working to change the situation, or to help people change their own situations. And our organization does not work without community members. It's not an organization like many organizations in Birmingham, which are trying to come in and save the community and don't really know how to help in the right way. We're an organization that helps the community accomplish and put their ideas into practice. I'm also a professor at Auburn University for now. That's kind of shaky. professor at Auburn University. I got a great wife. Her name's Robin Hyden. She's a community organizer for Alabama Arise, which is a great organization that you should check out. So, Majadi, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I'm Majadi Baruti. I'm a priest with Wuja Temple Ministries. I work with my beloved priestess, Marie Seychat, Susan Diane Mitchell. And we are here, of course, in Birmingham, Alabama. And our organization, our vibration is more of a spiritual one, but we hope to provide an undergirding of what actual activism, and what Susan, she refers to is practical life application. That's one of the things that attracted me to Magic City Agriculture Project, is that it's applying something that's real. When you talk about food, economic justice, and the dismantling of racism, you're looking at having to actually do something rather than have large forums. And, you know, man, you've been a part of these forums, and it gets tired where there's just a lot of discussion, and yet you see no actualized plan, no actualized, no action. There's no actual thing that you can point to and say, okay, we are doing this thing. And what Magic City Agricultural Project looks like is something that I can be a part of where we can actually do something in the community at a root level, as something that we all need. I mean, obviously the word agriculture is here. So if you can explain how, for us, Zach, how agriculture and food, how that's all tying into what the movement is about now.
So agriculture and food is the first economic system.
Right.
There was basically no economics until people started growing, till people started growing food. And we want to start out with that basis of growing food to build a new economic system in the community, one that will provide food, but will also provide independent business ownership through worker-owned cooperatives. So a worker-owned cooperative is just a business that's owned by the workers instead of some wealthy owner. So we want to provide, we want to help to create self-determination within black and poor communities so that they can control their economy. And again, we're starting this out at the very root of any kind of economic paradigm, which is food and agriculture. Now, we want to grow it out from there. We want to deal with housing and also the financial system, to create a different kind of financial system. But the real crux of what we're trying to do is to not only have worker owners provide food for their own communities, but also have them have a sustainable livelihood through the providing of that food.
What is that going to do to change the dynamics? Because it sounds like it's going to start changing the dynamics of a lot of things, not just the political structure and the economic structure, but also the educational structure. How can you, I mean, you're an instructor. How can you... Can you see, and how would that work out? You're looking at how people's access and the control of their food. You use the word self-determination, the key Swahili words, Kuja Chagalia, for this. How are people controlling their food? How does that work out for how they live their lives politically and education? Let's go into education as well. How does that work out?
Well, if you control the institutions in your community, which black folks and poor folks don't, then you have the ability to determine how those institutions function. So if the educational system is controlled by the community, and the community wants to teach, wants young people to read The Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams, they can read that. Owning your own business means that you get to make the decisions about that business. Right. And it means that you have the responsibility. And one of the things that we want to do with Magic City Agriculture Project is we want to take take worker owners on a step-by-step process into business ownership. We don't want to just give them money and throw them out there and say, survive. We want to help them to grow and learn and become leaders within their group so that they can survive out in the marketplace. But, I mean, one of the things that has to happen across the board among whites and blacks for this to be successful is that we have to have a renewed consciousness about who we are and how the system of white supremacy and capitalism shape us. Because my firm belief is, especially, I can't speak for black people, but for white people, we don't know who we are. And we try to help in black communities and poor communities. And all we do, we just become white saviors. We just go to the communities and we give out food and we give out resources and we don't ever teach people how to fish. And we don't know how to teach people how to fish.
That's an interesting perspective. That's a very interesting. We don't know how to teach people how to fish. So then you guys looking at community organizers from within the community becomes very, very crucial.
Yes.
That.
Black community organizers, hiring black community organizers for our organization is absolutely crucial for them to be able to go out and help people get this revolutionary consciousness. I can't, as a white person, I can't go teach a black person how to be conscious. I've never had that experience. I can teach a white person how to be conscious, but I can't teach a black person how to be conscious because I've never gone through the oppression of white supremacy. I benefit from white supremacy.
I'm glad. I like the way you said that. You've never gone through the process of white supremacy because you've... And then to say that you've benefited from it. Here's the interesting. How do other whites hear that? How are they responding to that? That, man, we're getting paid off of this. We're living off of this. I'm able to go to this, that, and the other college because of this. How are they responding to that when you're saying that?
I think there's a growing number of whites, especially white community leaders, who are ready to have this discussion. Magic City Agriculture Project, in conjunction with Black Lives Matters Birmingham, on April 23rd, is having a forum called What Can White People Do About Racism? A Forum of Self-Reflection for the White Community. And we have a number of very well-respected white community leaders, pastors, professors on the panel. So far, 92 people have said that they're going to come on Facebook. And I mean, it's not a gigantic number of people, but 92 right. is a significant number of people. And I think there is what you were getting at. There is a great deal of resistance to think for among white people to thinking about ourselves as beneficiaries of white supremacy. It's a great resistance to that because nobody wants to think of themselves as a racist.
Right. And you hear a lot of argumentation about that. I'm not a racist, but then somebody will say something in the media that is clearly a racist statement. I'm like, dude, what you just said? And the admission of that, that's really powerful. So 92 folks going out to that. This is going to be I'm going to definitely make it out. That's my intention to make it out. Cause I'm just interested. And see, I'm operating from this other position now.
Right.
Usually I've been on the board. I'm going to look at this and see how this is going to work out and hear the comments.
I want to see, I mean, for me, it's sort of a measuring stick as to how conscious the white community that actually cares is. Like, most white people don't actually care. Most white people don't actually care. But there is a small segment of the white community that actually cares, and I want to see how conscious they are.
That's interesting, because you're actually testing the folks who say that they care. And so you start moving them from a liberal vibration towards a more progressive vibration, right. And then even eventually possibly some radical change could take place. So.
Right, and there's people that are coming there that I know try really, really hard. Okay. They try really, really hard. But some of the stuff they do is very questionable.
Okay.
And I hope that this will give them the tools to think critically about the type of stuff that they do and to change it and to tweak it or to make it more effective or to be more connected to the communities that they work in. And like I said, Magic City Agriculture Project, you know, if there's a meeting in Titusville or Smithfield, we're at it. Okay. We show up. We show up at all these meetings. We've built relationships with many of the community and neighborhood presidents. And we I've been working in Birmingham since 2009. I started out working at Urban Ministry with Amash Ambalia and R.G. Wilson Lines. And we put out a plan this week, April 6th. And basically that is the culmination of 6 years of just listening. Just listening and trying to figure out what's going to be a meaningful project for the communities that we serve.
One of the things I've noticed is that that doesn't take place even within the Black community. Listening to elder Black folks and stuff that they've done, stuff that they've not done, mistakes that they've made, going back and looking at the historical example and really, really analyzing it. I hear a lot of folks I'll see folks that will quote certain books, but then you, like, get into a discussion, and maybe because I'm all nerdy and geeky, I've read the, like, entire book, you know, and you look at, okay, well, you really don't know what you're dealing with. And I'm seeing that seems to be the same thing in the white community. You're quoting, the first person people come up with is Dr. King. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, no understanding of all aspects of King.
It's the Santa Clausification of Dr. King.
I like that.
As Dr. Cornel West said, it's the Santa Clausification of Dr. King. It's taking one King quote out of a speech that he probably didn't even write. Making it stand for the body of King's work. You know, I mean, people don't know that King said, "I fear that I've integrated my people into a burning house."
Right.
You know,
right.
And that King later in his life was more of a revolutionary than a reformer.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's possibly why he died.
And speaking of revolutionaries, I see here, this is one of my favorite. I just like opening. Let's see. Okay, this Fannie Lou Hamer. You open up the brochure, and it's Fannie Lou Hamer right there. You already start off on a good foot. How has Fannie Lou Hamer and organizers like her been influential in Magic City culture, agriculture?
Project? So, I will tell you who is the most influential organizer for me.
Okay.
And I respect Fannie Lou Hamer, I respect Ella Baker, I respect Saul Linsky, you know, all of these organizers. But really, it's Paulo Freire for me.
Mm, mm.
And Paulo Freire was an educator who said that the educational system is oppressive. And it's oppressive because it places the teacher in the position of the oppressor, imparting knowledge to the passive recipient of the student. And what Freire said was that what has to happen is you have to have a dialogue-based education in which the oppressors and the oppressed enter into a real learning community together. So everything that I do in academia, in community organizing, everything that I do is predicated on the fact that I have to enter into a dialogue. I, as an oppressor, have to enter into a dialogue with the oppressed. And this is, a dialogue means something different than just having a conversation. A dialogue is true honesty, true trust, and true sense of shared destiny. So you have to enter into that dialogue with the oppressors, thereby humanizing both the oppressor and the oppressed.
Interesting construct. Because here in Birmingham, one of the terminologies that I hear all the time, and I've talked to my beloved Susan about it, that really annoys the living hell out of me, is the term over the mountain. You know, we talked about that, man. That really pisses me off. Over the mountain. Because what you're saying is you're speaking to a godhead. And what happens now is you've made this entity, because it's not even a group of people you're referencing. Like you said, you spoke to humanization of the oppressor. You're going to make the oppressor, you have two legs like I do. You eat food like I do. But you've created a God construct. And you cannot fight God. It's an impossible battle to destroy a God that is destroying you. So that actual dialogue starts that process of humanizing. Now, I'm looking at Birmingham, and I'm like, gosh, it seems like this is going to be a hell of a process. But what you're doing with the forum that's going to be held at the Beloved Community Church, maybe we'll give the information for that. We'll make sure we put the information out for that. that type of forum starts that process. It's going to have to be a really hard discussion. Mm-hmm. Folks are going to have to turn red. You forgive the expression. Mm-hmm. Folks are going to have to turn red. I mean, I don't know how that went over, but folks are going to have to turn red. Okay, and purple. In order to really, I mean, it's going to have to get in some gutsy stuff. Yeah. And we're going back to the construct of food and agriculture and the control of that. That's going to make some folks nervous, man. Some folks are going to have to going to feel uncomfortable.
So, you're right. And what we want to do with this conversation is we want to model for white people how to have the conversation.
Okay.
We want to say, this is the language that you need to use. This is how honest you need to be. And we want to encourage white people to be honest with ourselves.
Okay.
About white supremacy and our place in it. And if we could get some of those folks to start thinking critically about where we fit within white supremacy, then we're prepared to have the conversation with the oppressed. Okay. But currently, white people are not prepared to have an honest conversation with the oppressed. So we have to go do all of that work first before we can actually enter into the dialogue.
That's funny. Susan and I, we were at this, at the Edge of Chaos meeting, Edge of Chaos at UAB, having this discussion, and the last discussion, what was it called? It was Edge of Chaos. I always forget the byline. Edge of Chaos something.
Wicked problems.
Right. And so, this one dealing with racism. And there were two people that actually used the term global white supremacy. And it was Susan and Professor Huntley, they used the terminology. And Susan addressed certain things. I mean, the way she says things, man, it's so funny because the way she says things, she has a soft voice, but then all this power, this intellect comes through this, comes through this voice. You're like, damn, did she just say that? And she, like, put it back on what you're saying, put it back on the oppressor to say, I am doing thus and such, and I participated in, and there was that refusal. They did that wall, man. They put up that wall. Well, it's not me, and can we share some cookies and some donuts, and maybe everything will smooth over? I mean, she kept going at it. She kept going at it. She would not let up. But on the other hand, there were black folk there. And there was a dishonest discussion on our side as well, where we refuse to say the uncomfortable thing about what we're feeling. You know, there's that, you know how families do. They have that family discussion at the dinner table when they're going to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Then there's a family discussion at the house. It's Archie Bunker.
Yeah.
Everybody's got the Archie, all cultures have the Archie Bunker conversation. You know, they use the N-word. They say words like honky. I mean, we using all these things and saying all this stuff at the house. And that's what we're really feeling.
Right.
That's what we're really thinking, right, man. And even amongst black folks, we adamantly refuse, still many of us, to say certain things because we don't want, which sounds funny even about to say this, we don't want the oppressor to feel uncomfortable.
Well, it's not just that. It is that, but it's also the fact that black folks have been punished for years and years and years for being honest with white folks.
Right.
And this is how, and it's not necessarily as bad now. Black folks aren't going to get killed for it, but they still will be censored and they'll be called angry. They'll be called confrontational. They'll be called so on and so forth. So black folks have learned that we just can't talk to white people about race. We can't be honest with white people because they can't handle it.
Right.
So, I mean, this is from my perspective as
a
white person.
That's a perfect example. There was a scholar, Dr. Frances Creswell, and I refer to her. She made the statement when she was talking. She's a psychologist, and she was talking to a black child. And she asked the black child, "Don't you want to grow up and be like Dr. King or Malcolm X?" And the child said, "No, because if you grow up and help black people, you will be killed." And so there's this underlying thought process that there's, you know, obviously you're going to be subject to murder if you begin to rebel against said oppressor. And I guess there's, so I'm just looking at there's difficult conversations to be had on either side mm-hmm. of the so-called fence or railroad track or whatever. There's a difficult conversation that has to be had. Before we get into, which is what you're alluding to, before we get into a full conversation between the parties, there has to be this conversation on either side.
It has to be conscious black people and conscious white people.
Right.
It can't be anything other than that to have a real conversation.
Right, and we see I've seen things on AL.com and on the Weld website where that's not what's happening. Because you've been involved in a couple of those debates. Like, who the hell are these people? Where are they coming from? I mean, all this just wild...
Out there stuff. Tinfoil hat stuff.
Yeah. It's like... it has to be... there's a controlled situation where these conversations can be had. And like you're saying, it has to be the conscious black folks and conscious white folks having that conversation.
I like, what you said made me think of something. So, we posted the event on the Magic City Agriculture Project Facebook page.
Yeah.
And one guy came on there and said, "Well, you're calling all white people racist." So then later he came on and said, "You're just doing this to raise money." And I said, "So we are raising money by calling white people racist?"
Right.
That doesn't seem like a good strategy to me.
No, the people with the money. Right. Wait, I didn't even think about it like that.
Doesn't seem like a good strategy
right.
to me.
Right. The people with the money, we'll call them racist. Yeah, that's what we do. That's a smart move. We'll get about 23 cents out of that. What I want to do is go into some of the strategic plan.
Okay.
And this is where we get into some of the details of the MCAP. The first one, I'm really... Yeah, let's just go ahead and go in order. Let's start with the cooperative and... Let me get this right. The Cooperative and Aquaponics Training Center.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and explain that for us.
So, a cooperative and aquaponics training center, it's got two parts, which is that it will train people on business principles and cooperative principles.
Okay.
So it'll teach them how to run their own cooperatives. The other part is the aquaponics part, which is an agricultural system that is highly productive but can be done on a small scale. And it combines hydroponics and aquaculture, eliminating the weaknesses of both types of systems. In aquaculture, which is the raising of fish, the fish effluent soils the water and the water has to constantly be clean. In hydroponics, which is growing plants in water, the plants have to be fertilized with a chemical slurry. In aquaponics, the fish effluent fertilizes the plants, and the plants clean the water, so you have a completely self-contained, basically an ecosystem. Okay. It's highly productive. A quarter-acre aquaponics farm would produce 140,000 heads of lettuce and 12,000 pounds of whole fish a year. A retail price for a head of lettuce is $1.99 or $2.
Yeah,
and you're talking about $280,000 to $300,000 a year, potentially, on a quarter-acre. In a cooperative, you don't have to have profit. So, because the dividends are split up between the worker owners. So basically all you're having to do in a cooperative is pay the salaries of the worker owners. They would split the proceeds of whatever they sold. Now, is this going to be easy to do? No, it's not going to be easy to do. There's going to be problems all the way through it. But the key part is being able to train apprentices to be able to start their own independent worker-owned cooperatives. The training center, the proceeds of the training center itself, will go to pay for the salaries of the apprentices and fund Magic City Agriculture Project.
Okay.
We will take, after at least 2 years, We will help the apprentices through the Farm Service Administration and other people making agricultural loans secure a loan to start their own aquaponics farm.
Okay, okay. And briefly, the fish that are associated with, are they edible as well?
Yes.
That's the idea?
We're going to grow tilapia.
Okay, okay.
But you can grow anything, and you can even, in fact, grow prawns.
Really?
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe down the road, one of the cooperatives that we start could grow prawns, and they could sell Birmingham Magic City-grown prawns at one of the restaurants in Birmingham.
That would be that would be a stupendous moneymaker.
Yeah, it'd be a huge moneymaker.
Okay, and the second one, I'm looking at the Community Development Financial Institution, the CDFI, and the Community Enterprise Zone. Okay. This one is very, very interesting. Can you explain that for us?
Community Enterprise Zone is a policy that we designed. The zone contains 50,000 low, is a geographic area of 50,000 low-income people. It has two policy pieces. The first is a $10 million capitalization of a community development financial institution, which is basically a community-controlled bank. The other part of the policy is a tiered tax break system that favors democratic businesses. It's a job credit system that favors democratic businesses. So, cooperatives would receive the most job credits. Unionized businesses would receive the second amount of job credits. And just any traditional business with regular employees would receive the third level of job credit. So, you know, any type of business can receive these credits, but it just incentivizes having democratized businesses.
Okay. Okay. I like that one a lot. When I worked in radio some years ago, I noticed that in Youngstown, Ohio specifically, they would have these businesses come in, and they would say, we're going to have, and it was really, you had to read it really carefully. They were given tax incentives to bring the business in, but they would say stuff like, okay, we're going to have, I forget the wording, but it was, you know, apparently lawyers wrote it, and they would say things like, we're going to have thus and such many jobs produced from this business. The problem is, those jobs weren't inside of the community in which that building would sit. In fact, the people would be brought in from other states to come and work the job. So they did bring in, quote unquote, XYZ jobs, 35 jobs or whatever. And then they get this tax break. And the tax breaks were massive. I mean, they were huge tax breaks these guys were getting. And so I'm reporting on this. And they said, well, we did say we were going to bring in. I mean, they were just, it was just this, back when I was back in the 90s, we used terms like tricknology instead of technology. tricknology. And that's what it was. They're using other words. So this, in this case, is because it's within the community itself. Now, the physical, quote unquote, bank or the CDFI is in the community itself.
Right.
So you can't help but to have people within the community.
Right. And there would be a provision that the job credits that the businesses receive will have to hire something like 75% from within the zone, the zone itself.
Good, good.
This is a sort of evolution of the Clintonian era empowerment zones.
That's what they were called. That's exactly
the empowerment zones. This is sort of our sort of step further.
Okay.
They also had a geographic requirement for hiring people. That would be included.
Okay. Then we have the Community Land Trust, another very interesting one. Could you explain what that is? That deals with housing, looks like.
Yes. Community Land Trust is a institution for housing and business ownership that's hallmark feature is dual ownership. So the trust, the actual trust that is formed, which would be a 501c3 nonprofit, owns the grounds that a house or business is built on. The individual homeowner or the business owner owns the improvements to the grounds. Now, the homeowners or business owners have representatives that sit on the trusts, and we would insist that they would have a majority of representatives that sit on the trust. And not only is this, what this does is it drops the cost of entrance into the housing market. If you don't have to pay for the land and you only have to pay for the improvements, your price goes down.
Right.
What it also does is it gives communities a tool for land use planning. So if the trust owns a bunch of these properties throughout the community, then the people on the trust get to decide how that land is put to use. And it collectively can guide land use planning within the community. It's basically the two things that it's for is for low-income home ownership. And if you compare that to what the city's proposing with their gentrification with justice, which they wanted to incentivize affordable housing, what that means is that they want to give tax breaks to apartment owners. That's what it means. It is not a program for low-income home ownership.
Okay.
And that's what we're proposing is a program for low-income home ownership and also community-controlled land use plans.
Excellent. Okay, and this is probably one of my favorite ones. I have two of these six that are my favorite, the ones that really hit me in the heart. And this one is Magic City Grown. Certification available for farmers and restaurants in the seven counties of Greater Birmingham. And then you talk about this will aid in product marketing.
Yes.
Can you explain the Magic City Grown?
Magic City Grown is a brand. It's a triple bottom line brand. And the triple bottom line means that in order for a business to be considered profitable, it must be economically, socially, and environmentally profitable. And what this does is it makes sure that the business practices of the farm fit within a broad, progressive idea of how a business should work. But it also will allow farms and restaurants to charge a premium for their product. So an aquaponics cooperative in Titusville could produce for the community by having a U-Pick at their facility. So people could come in and they could pick the food or they could get the fish or whatever they need to do. But that same aquaponics cooperative could use the brand to sell to restaurants and especially to high-end restaurants and get a premium for the product that they pay. It just adds value to the products that would be produced by these operations.
Okay. And I'll tell you what, we're going to go ahead and take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll discuss the last two of those, and we'll go into some other aspects of what Magic City Agricultural Project is doing. You're listening to Magic City Agricultural Project. I am Majadi Baruti, and of course I'm here with the brilliant Zach Henson. We're going to take a brief moment, and we'll be back with you in just a second.
And a
All right. You are listening to, of course, that's the brilliant elder statesman, poet, revolutionary, Gil Scott-Heron, and his beautiful song, Winter in America. I want to thank you for joining us here on the Magic City Agricultural Project. We are pursuing freedom, justice, equality, harmony, righteousness, and peace and love and all kinds of good stuff like that for every human being in the sound of our voice. I am Majadi Baruti, and I'm joined by the brilliant Zach Henson. And what we're doing today is, this is our introductory program. We're discussing the goals and the mission statement, the strategic plans of MCAP, Magic City Agricultural Project. And we hope to bring on some brilliant guests, some poignant conversation. But let me be point blank. This is a revolutionary process. This is revolution. This is not just about beautiful social change and all kinds of little cutesy-pootsy stuff. This is really the gutsy thing. This is the rootsy thing. This is a folk music movement, a folk movement. This is a movement of the people, by the people, for the people. And this is rooted in love. Real revolutionaries know what real love is. And we're going to continue our conversation with Zach Henson and really get into some good conversation about some other ideas that that we want to approach with the future shows and really present something completely different to not only the area of Birmingham, but perhaps a different type of fighting and resistance than you've seen before. This is the real thing. This is the real thing. I'm getting this old vibration of Robert F. Williams in me. Oh, man. Wow. Robert F. Williams out of North Carolina, he and his wife, Mabel, he at one point was a member of the NAACP. This is during the 60s, and he tried his damnedest to work with that particular organization to see. He was the president of the NAACP there in North Carolina. And he tried his damnedest to work within the confines of the organization to have the white supremacists that were there. It's around the Charlotte area. And I always forget the little town that's north of Charlotte. Concord. Yeah, the Concord area. Trying to resist that, the murder of the children, black children there. And he found no other way but to use other means other than nonviolence. And the NAACP said, well, you can't do it here, and you can't do it representing our name. So then Robert F. Williams goes on with Mabel, and they form a black gun club and some other things to defend themselves. And what we're saying, in essence, is, I mean, then, of course, they moved on, and they inspired other folks. And then they moved on into Cuba and whatnot, and his name is always remembered there. There's a book called Negroes with Guns, if you can check that out. Check out Robert F. Williams' work. And the interesting thing is, he started with this kind of underground communication. They had this thing called Radio Free Dixie, which is, I believe, if I remember right from the book that I read, it broadcast all the way from Cuba, all the way into, and it would go as far north as the southern tip of North Carolina, from what I understand. And I'm like, wow. that's pretty hardcore. So you chase him out of there, and he's still coming at you. He's like that's like gangster. You know, a real gangster. That's gangster right there. And it's starting to feel that kind of way, that this is, we've got to use other means to communicate, and we got to communicate some other means.
Yeah.
You know, we got to say some other things.
And so. It's easier now. I mean, we don't have to have a 100,000 watt transmitter to push it out all the way to North Carolina. You know, we can put a podcast on the internet and get people to listen to it. You know, we got social media, we got blogs, we got lots of ways to reach people and to get the information out there and start touching people and changing people's hearts and minds.
Right. So what we're going to do, we're going to get on into, because we're going to deal with some ideas of economics, but what we're going to do is get on to those last 2 points of the 6 main objectives of MCAP's strategic plan. And point 5 is the creation of a 501c4. Could you explain that for us, Zach?
A 501c4 is just a lobbying group. From what I can tell, it is sort of in the discussion stages in our organization right now. From what I can tell, it's going to focus on economic policy and democracy.
Okay.
We're in the discussion stages, so there's not really a whole lot to tell, but it's going to be a lobby group. We're going to try to get policies changed.
Okay. All right. And then that 6th one, let me get into this juicy conversation dealing with the concept of economics and what that means for the new day. Because clearly the economics that we've been working with has not been prosperous for everyone. The last point that we have on the main objectives is the Birmingham Institution for Social Change, BISC. What is that?
Birmingham Institute for Social Change is an anti-racist and community organizing training that is targeted at white people. Okay. So the training is a 2-day training. The first day, we walk white folks through. I mean, black folks are allowed to come for sure, but it's targeted at white people. We walk white folks through institutional and cultural racism with interactive exercises, and then the second day we sort of say the way to engage correctly is do community organizing the right way. Okay. You have to have the first day before you can get to the second day.
Yeah.
And what it does is it gives white folks, it starts them on a path. It's not the end of the journey. It's not going to teach white folks everything they need to know. But it is going to get them to start thinking more critically. As I've said numerous times, their place in white supremacy. And if we can get them started thinking about that type of stuff, maybe they'll pick up a book, you know, and start reading some scholars like W.E.B. Du Bois or Chancellor Williams or Frantz Fanon. Start reading some of these scholars and start thinking about their relationship to these scholars and how they are positioned within, especially a book like Black Skin, White Mask.
I was just thinking that. When you mentioned Fanon, that's the first thing that came to mind. His more well-known book, I guess, is Wretched of the Earth.
Right.
But I'm going to tell you, that Black Skin, White Mask,
It's a good book for white people to read, if they will read it. And when Fanon says white people, they don't think, oh, well, he's not talking about me because I'm a different type of white person.
Okay. As long as
they'll read it and say, oh, he's talking about me.
Yeah, because he definitely is doing that.
He is definitely doing that. If we will say it, we'll read it, and we'll say he's talking about me, then we can get somewhere, you know. But if we read it and we just say, you know, well, I'm not like that. I'm just not like that. Well, it's probably not going to get anywhere. So.
Right. I think, that's going to be really, really, really interesting to see how that plays out, because we are smack dab in the middle of, you know, powerful people don't want to, you know, lose their power. There is no, I think it was, Dr. John Henry Clark, late Dr. John Henry Clark, historian, he said that powerful people never educate the victims of their power on how to take power from them. You can't, in other words, you can't simply go to the schools and figure out how to destroy global white supremacy, how to destroy patriarchy. It's just not going to happen. There's nothing in that that's going to show you the methodology by which you have to follow. So you have to use other means. I mean, we're using this as a means of showing. I mean, this is going to say we are attempting a move that is consistent with other moves in the past and the present in toppling racism, global white supremacy, patriarchy, and I really want to get into the economic meat of it. Why don't you go there for a moment? What are the economic structures? I'm looking for the structures that are in place that prevent everybody from a harmonious amount of food, shelter, and clothing with the other folk who have all the food, shelter, and clothing more than what they could possibly use.
Right. So the situation that we're in globally in the world today is that there is more than enough stuff produced than everybody in the world needs. We could feed the world twice over. We have more than enough houses. There's more empty houses in Utah than there is homeless people. Mm. Now, think about that for a minute. Mm. There is more empty houses in Utah than there is homeless people. And the underlying reason for this is that the people who make all the stuff don't receive the benefits of the stuff that is made.
Okay.
So, okay. And this happened in 1600s, 1700s. And you had farmers who were working the land and producing their own goods and services, and were independent. Well, they were dispossessed by the land, and they went to the cities. Right. And this is how urbanization has picked up over the past 200 years.
Right.
More people live in cities now than ever lived. More of the population lives in cities now than lives in rural areas. Okay. That's the first time in human history. So they were dispossessed from the land, and they moved to cities, and the only thing that they had to sell was their labor. So they sold their labor to the people who bought the land and made the products for the people who bought the land, made the products that they had been making for the people who bought the land. The people who bought the land then sold the products, paid the what had become a laborer, who was a farmer, had become a laborer, paid the laborer a pittance to do what they had already been doing,
right,
and profited, right. And profited from being able to buy this labor.
This is old hat. I'm listening to you, and I'm hearing hip-hop. I'm hearing, that's exactly, here is the poor, black, Latino, and poor white youth of New York City, of Chicago, of L.A., who produce a what is now a global consciousness, a culture. KRS-One, Public Enemy, Chuck D, and those of us who refer to it as a culture, we live it. We produced it, and now a corporation has taken it, and now it sells it back to us. And, I mean, in really some quite repulsive forms. This is not what I gave you. What are you talking? This is not what I gave the planet. I gave you food. I gave you corn and beans and kale and spinach. And you gave me a Twinkie. You know, that's the same concept. Because the stuff that we get back from these corporations, from these, the landowners, I'll say the landowners, because that's the same, basically the same thing, it's Twinkies. That's what we get back. iPods and iPads and little cute things to keep us preoccupied and just continuously laboring for them.
And the key here is to understand property.
Okay.
Before there was capitalism, the farmers farmed on commons. They shared the land,
right,
and farmed collectively. And in some places that still exists, the ejido system in Mexico. They shared the land. Well, landowners and rich people, basically, invented private property and started,
right,
enclosing the commons.
Right.
And that dispossessed people from the land. So your example of rap music the hip-hop artists were dispossessed from their product through intellectual property.
Okay.
The idea that you can own an idea.
Right.
And
right.
just say, like, seeds. Seeds are now intellectual property. If you have Monsanto seeds and you plant them 1 year, you buy Monsanto seeds and you plant them 1 year, if you save those seeds and replant them another year, you are breaking the law.
Right, because you have to keep purchasing.
Because you don't own it.
Because you don't own it.
You're allowed.
Oh, because you would be making an heirloom, in effect.
Yeah.
Then I mean, it was kind of gross.
You would turn it into a commons. Like seeds throughout human history have been commons. People share them.
Right.
You know, that's how you got hybrids and all these different varieties. You know, all of these farmers came together and they said, you know, hey, I got this kind of corn and this is what we grow over here. And this farmer said, hey, I got this kind of corn we grow over here. And then they plant them together and they get a completely new kind of corn.
Okay.
And they've always been a commons for years and years and years. And through the brilliance of intellectual property, they're able to take what had been owned by everyone and have it owned by a corporation with an army of lawyers to defend that. And, like, not to do an advertisement for Magic City Agriculture Project, but everything that we're trying to help local people create is a commons.
Right.
The cooperative would be owned by a group of people who manage it and do it themselves. A community development financial institution would be, the board of directors would be a group of community people who would own it and manage it themselves. It's all a commons. And Eleanor Ostrom, who was a really talented Nobel Prize winner in economics, showed using mainstream economic theory, which is not favorable to the idea of commons, she showed that commons was actually the rational way to manage resources.
Okay. Because it's based off of the land itself. And actually, to take it to a kind of a spiritual vibration, because the people were in attunement with the land, they operated like the land wanted them to operate, mm-hmm. as opposed to, I am going to control this dynamic. Mm-hmm. I have this. This is my tree. And this is my plot of land and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and these groups of people who had these commons, it wasn't just a free-for-all. They had rules. They had rules that they developed themselves that were in tune with the way the land worked, and they were situated within a specific piece of property. So if somebody, you know, if some group of people works a commons in a valley between a mountain range, then they're going to have rules that are situated and fit to those specific environmental conditions, instead of, you know, let's dump millions of gallons of water on a desert in Central Valley so that we can, you know, grow almonds, you know,
which is irrational.
It's just an irrational.
Right. It's completely right.
It's an irrational way to farm.
But that's the funny thing. Those who operate in controlled dynamic, those who operate in the vibration of I have this and I have that, it is, my beloved and I have discussed this kind of mind frame in context of patriarchy, and it is psychopathic. To own something that was there millions of years prior to you existing, prior to you being a twinkling in your mama's eye, there's something wrong with you psychologically that you think you can actually do that. It's really, really, and so I think that when we're dealing with this thing, this is something I was thinking earlier, I say, well, gosh, when we're dealing with this thing, what actually are we dealing with? I mean, who are we actually talking at? We know who we're talking to. We are talking to the same. We're talking to the people who are actually have some understanding. When you're talking to poor folks and oppressed people, they're not stupid. Although some folks want to talk to them like that, but then you have to look at, what are you saying to the oppressor? Who are you actually addressing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge question.
Yeah, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, who? Yeah. I mean, because I said that, I think
there's got to be people.
It's got to be people.
There's got to be people somewhere, you know, right. that are making these decisions. It's not, I mean, it's not just some automatic system, like, no. Some robotic system.
But we do
system.
Think of it like yeah. that. I think that the oppressed and just the average everyday Jane thinks of it like it's just, this is just how it works. Because we talk like that. We say, well, you know, this is how things are. And that's a very dangerous mm-hmm. kind of place to be in. It's like being smacked upside your head repeatedly. Blood starts gushing from your head, but you have, like, no awareness that this is taking place. You just, oh, yeah, I saw that blood. I didn't think much of it. Yo, you're bleeding to death. Well, you're going to die at some point. This, wait a minute, not by your own design. You're going to die with the bad food, the lack of access of good food because it's controlled. We're going to have a grocery store only here. And the gardens that grow the food, quote unquote, the food that we put in the grocery store, you never see it.
Yeah,
it's a great sleight of hand thing.
They're huge. It's 14,000 acres. I mean, combines that are GPS guided without pilots or, you know, harvesting the crop. It's just, I mean, it's really, I mean, in some ways it's amazing.
Okay, wait a minute. Okay, hold on. I think I've seen that on some imagery before. So the combine, that's this huge machine. I don't know the names of it. Okay.
It's a machine that harvests the crop.
Right, and it's moving by itself, guided by some GPS system.
Yeah. That's what harvests your food.
So basically, there's no human in this whole process.
No labor. Or there might be a little bit of labor, but, I mean, none to speak of.
Probably to maintain the machine.
To maintain.
Someone that, you know, with a wrench or whatever to maintain the machine.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that. It's water is piped in from the Colorado River to California to fertilize the Central Valley. It's all controlled by computers. It's all done. It's all just completely automated. It goes to a farm. There's no labor on the farm. It's just, it's a technological, I mean, whoever invented it was a genius. I mean, it's really amazing. But it's like creepy. It's like
yeah,
really
yeah.
creepy.
I'm sitting there, my heart is beating fast. I'm like, I'm serious. I'm like, kind of like, I mean, I was aware of that, but very loosely, and I guess I probably wanted to pretend like I didn't have a full grasp of that. And now, as I'm sitting here thinking, because this movie's coming up, I'm a big comic book geek, so I'm waiting for Age of Ultron, mm-hmm. the Avengers, and this is what Tony Stark has done. He's created an artificial intelligence to, quote unquote, protect us. And damn thing decides, well, the only way I'm going to protect you people, you things, is to kill you. Because you're too stupid to do it of your own. And us having machines that mow that produce the chicken McNuggets, you know, automatically. I mean, that's what it is.
We don't know our own machine
to kill us.
You talk about a farm in this, and you look at the marketing about farms and everything. People think that farms are, you know, there's some, like the Dodge commercial that had all the white farmers on it, you know,
a
couple of years ago at the Super Bowl. And they think it's this, you know, folksy old guy with a cowboy hat.
Yeah,
It's not that. It's like living on a family farm that's like 100 acres and they're growing goats and like all this. I'm not arguing that we should go back to that. I'm saying we do need to use technology in the appropriate way. And I don't think pouring fertilizer and having combines harvest crops automatically is the appropriate way to grow food.
No, because there's, I mean, one of the things we're dealing with economics, man, there's jobs in that.
Yeah.
There's jobs in that. I mean, the farmer was a job. They had jobs. The Black Farmers Association in the lawsuit that they won eventually, I think it's something like 20 years, so they could get they were talking about discrimination with, tax benefits and all kinds of little insurance, all kinds of little things were tied into that process. But the times that I see what I perceive might be a black farmer is when I go to that, what's that place? The place where they have, it's on Saturdays, held on Saturday morning, you've taken me there. It's a pepper place. And I've seen one person, two, three people, black, that are selling some food or what have you.
Which is way better than it was when they first started Pepper Place. They didn't have any black farmers there. Wow. And people criticized them, and, you know, they sort of have, I mean, made some strides, but not really.
I guess it was kind of like one of those things where like, okay.
Yeah.
All right, we'll have some black farmers, fine.
Like, well,
oh, yeah. I didn't even think about them, right.
I mean, but the thing about technology is the capitalists have always used technology to attack labor. For instance, computers. Is anybody you know employed as a file clerk anymore?
No.
It doesn't exist.
No.
The job doesn't exist.
No.
And capitalists have used computers to eliminate that job and cut costs.
Right. That's funny, because there are certain positions that, the last quote-unquote job I held was in, with the bank, Wells Fargo, which had been Wachovia, which felt really weird when they took over. And I began to perceive where, except for the hard stubbornness of some Americans and their yearning for Americana, I want to hear a human voice. You know, they've got to hear, and they don't want any of those foreigners, whatever that is. I could see where automated responses could have done exactly what I was doing. They would call in, they would ask very specific questions, except for me. You know, I'm the guy that, and I might as well say it now, I'm the guy at Wells Fargo that you call, and you're looking for the refund on your fees, and I'm giving you all of it, you know, because I'm just an ass like that, you know, because I actually like you better than I like the corporation. I didn't give a damn. And they would get really hot with me about that whole business. Like, okay, man, look, you're giving away too much money. You know, it's not your money. It's not my money. You, Mr. Supervisor guy, it's not your cash. What are you talking? Like, you all the guard dog. Must be this cartoon where the dog was like, guard. That's what they sound like. You idiot, this is not your cash. What are you talking about? You don't lose anything in this process.
But don't you believe in the Wells Fargo team?
Yeah. The team of coaches with the coach and the it was sheer insanity. And here's the irony. Wachovia was sweeter and they were more fluffy bunny than Wells Fargo. However, Wachovia's money was tied into the enslavement of Africans. It was really just this whole mind-numbing weirdness thing. I'm like, okay, you enslaved Africans, or your corporation is tied to that kind of money, the family or what have you, and yet you have this fluffy bunny multicultural diversity approach, but you've never dealt with this thing.
Right.
But I guess this is what we're talking about. When we talk about the liberal whites and blacks who think that they're progressive, and they all gather together and they have these really pretty rainbow coalition parties, and they present this fluffy bunny kind of discussion about racism.
There's a guy named Dylan Rodriguez who calls it, I think I, this might be wrong, but I think he called it multicultural white supremacy, which is that you pick a certain people that look a certain way and fit, you know, and then you put them on there and you say, look at us, we're multicultural, when you're not really multicultural.
Right.
It's really all the same culture.
Right.
It's just that you've picked out the people that fit in that, that can fit in that culture.
Right.
And it's really still white supremacy with just a different face on it.
I was on this diversity task force in Ohio, and it was like that. It was like this thing, and I kept saying that. I said, what you perceive as multicultural is actually whiteness, and you are defining the circle or the box. It's not a circle. That would give it too much soul. defining the box. You can only be this much African. In fact, you can only be this much black. We're not going to reference you as African. We're sure in the hell not going to do that. You can only be this much Chinese. You can only, okay, you're a woman? Okay, that's cute. You know, and it's all this hyper maleness and hyper whiteness, I guess you could call it. And it maintains that box, and it keeps that box there. And then it plays out in the economics. It plays out in the politics.
it plays out in activism. I mean, you know, I think it's a really big challenge for white activists not to means test activists of color.
Okay.
And which is to say, you have to be an activist in the same way that I'm an activist.
Right.
And right. I think it's a challenge for our organization to make sure that we are getting good people mm-hmm. and not getting necessarily the right people.
Okay.
You know what
okay.
I'm saying?
Okay.
Like, we don't need to create some sort of like super exclusive culture that we all have to act and be the same way in our organization. I think that what's really important is for us to find good people who are talented, who may be different from us and may make us uncomfortable at times. I think that's really, you know, makes for a strong organization.
It will. I can see where it's going to test us all. It's going to make us so that we're challenged. Mm-hmm. Like okay, well, Majadi, man, that was kind of rough, man. Or do you think you maybe could have been rougher? You know,
yeah.
Maybe that was a little fluffy bunny, man. Which what you just said, you know, and pushing us, and then challenging us to read other information that we have not had access to research things that we have not looked into. This is going to make what the essence of true diversity in organizations
right.
should be or could be.
Yeah, in our board meetings, I encourage people to speak up and challenge me. I had one of our board members, he called me and asked me, he said, was I out of line? I said, no. I said,
right.
no, I absolutely, this is what I want. This is going to make us a strong organization.
Oh, yeah. And then when we go out, and then, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a family. You start
yeah.
creating a family concept where they start the little arguments between the brothers, between the sisters, between the sisters and the brothers. And what happens is, we go out there, though, and we're tight.
Exactly.
We're tight. And,
exactly.
and lethal. I mean,
exactly.
because you've got all these different vantage points. You can't catch us because we got this dude over here and we have this sister over here. She will bust your head open, which is what she's about to say.
We're not there. We're definitely not there, but I hope we can get there.
All right. I tell you what, we're going to go ahead and this is a very, very good program. I think this really, really worked. And I'm looking forward to some of the interviews, some of the people we want to talk to in the future. You have any ideas about folks who might want to speak with in the future?
I think I would like to probably speak with Mark Kelly, for sure.
Okay.
Maybe Zelda Divine Mind. Maybe
okay.
A.V. Ashante Shabazz.
Okay.
Maybe Scott Douglas, who's Greater Birmingham Ministry. Yeah, I got some ideas. Lawton Higgs.
I think
Lawton Higgs would certainly come on. You know, we want to speak with people trying to do stuff in the community. They don't have to be revolutionaries to come on our program. Now, they might get some hard questions
yeah.
if they come on the program, but they don't have to be revolutionaries. We just want people that are trying to make positive change in the community.
Okay, do we have any events that we have planned so far that are coming up that the public might want to be aware of? We're going to definitely put it with the podcast or what have you when we send
okay.
it out as well. But any events?
So, April 23rd. Is the forum, What Can White People Do About Racism? It's at Beloved Community Church in Avondale at 6:30. That's April 23rd at 6:30 at Beloved Community Church. It is a forum targeted at the white community, but all people are welcome to come. And we hope that there will be people of color that will come and make sure that we don't do anything stupid.
Okay. All right, Zach. thank you. That's pretty funny. All right. Thank you very much, Zach, and we look forward to doing some of this powerful programming in the future. I want to thank you for joining us here. I am Majadi Baruti. We are Magic City Agriculture Project. Thank you for joining us. Peace and blessings to you.
with us. We know you could've stayed home, just cried and cussed. May all your guns go off if it's time to bust. May all their tanks have time to rust. They got the armies turning bullets into gold. They got the hookers turning tricks into cold. And every time the police kicks in the dough, an angel gas breaks, dips in the O. And even if a D-boy flips in my O, it ain't enough to buy shit anymore. Sleep in the doorway, piss on the floor. Look in the sky, wait for missiles to show. It's finna blow, cause they got the TV, we got the truth. They own the judges and we got the proof. We got hella people, they got helicopters. They got the bombs and we got the
guillotine.
Exploding. Please, sir, may we have another portion with children of the beast that dodged the abortion. Neck plate firm between the floor and the portion. We'll shut your shit down, don't call it extortion. Caution, we're coming for your head. So call the feds and get files to shred. Every textbook read said bring you the bread. But guess what, we got you instead.
We got the guillotine.